MacCast, Wednesday, February 15th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. I hope you are having a wonderful week. Looking over the show notes here, it has been a huge week or so for Apple. We have a lot of things to talk about. We're going to be getting into Apple Pay a little bit, looking at what's going on with Apple Pay in Australia. They're having some troubles down there. We're going to talk about Tim Cook and Apple's interest in AR. He made some more comments about that this week. There's rumors of a possible new Apple connector, or maybe not. We're going to get into Apple Campus a little bit, Apple TV news, more Mac news, iPhone news, Apple Watch stuff, just a ton of things. Some issues with the LG displays to talk about also. Going to get into all of that, as well as some of your feedback and some of your comments. Want to get into Apple's record-breaking quarter. We're going to talk a little bit about more alternatives to Time Capsule. I had some great feedback from you on that. Going to get into understanding Apple's new file system, something that showed up. If you remember from last week's episode, we talked a little bit about it showing up in the iOS 10.3 beta. And a few more tips and tricks. Plus, I have a great thing of the moment for you this week. And this is exciting. We are going to announce the recipient, the person who is going to be receiving the AirPods from the MacCast AirPod giveaway. Will it be you? Stay tuned for later in the show. But, or you can just jump ahead, I suppose. At this point, it's a podcast, right? No, don't do that. Listen to this great show we got for you. It's going to be a lot of fun. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient recipe and delivery service in the country. It's their mission to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. And they achieve that by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. And we've been enjoying Blue Apron meals for a few weeks now. And I have to tell you, amazing stuff. I've been eating better than I have in a long time. And good home-cooked stuff as well. We recently had cashew stir-fried chicken with tango mandarins and jasmine rice. Delicious. Just tonight, we had the roasted pork with apple and walnut farro salad. And if you don't know what farros are or what farro is, I didn't either. It's this great grain. And what's cool about Blue Apron is each week they have great new recipes to pick from. So you're always getting new stuff. They will kind of auto-select your next week's recipes based on your previous choices. But you can go in there, go into the website, and you can change those selections to meet your dietary needs, or even change it for your taste preferences. So we kind of go in there every week, check out what's coming up, and that's a whole fun experience as well. And I have to tell you, the quality and freshness of the ingredients has been amazing. And I think that's in big part because Blue Apron sources those ingredients locally, and they're really committed to sustainable, responsible, and regenerative food sources. A huge advantage for us with Blue Apron has also just been learning about all the new flavors and spices and different varieties of foods from different regions. Like I said, farro, I had no idea. It was delicious. And we are becoming better cooks and learning about all this stuff. And it's actually, believe it or not, this one surprised me the most. It's helping my kids become less picky eaters because they're kind of excited about the experience. You know, the package arrives each week with all the ingredients and just the whole process of making it, putting it together. It's kind of become a family thing, and trying new things becomes exciting, and they're willing to do it. They don't like everything that they've tried, but they're learning new flavors, and that's been great for our family. And because the meals come with step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe cards and ingredients lists, that means that we can reuse the stuff that we like. And it's been expanding our total menu, all our family meal choices. And we've really enjoyed that about the service. And we've already planned to remake several of the meals. We're ordering some of the ingredients and spices that we've learned about, and Blue Apron makes it easy for us to do that. And best of all, as a MacCast listener, you can try out Blue Apron completely free. You can check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free, along with free shipping, by going to blueapron.com/MacCast. And you are going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/MacCast for your free meals. And a big thank you to Blue Apron for supporting the MacCast. I have to tell you, Apple Pay in Australia seems to be having a little bit of a rough go down there, down under. And maybe some of you in that region can sort of chime in and let us know, is it as bad as we're hearing or not? But it sounds pretty bad from what I've been reading. So far, apparently only one major bank, ANZ, currently supports Apple Pay in Australia. I guess it's also available through American Express, some internet banks, and many credit unions in the region. But Apple has been kind of at odds, and this has been since the beginning. A number of major Australian banks have kind of been doing battle with Apple and Apple Pay. They are arguing, or tried to argue, that Apple was in breach of antitrust down there by not allowing other payment systems to use the NFC chip built into the iPhone. And they had filed a complaint, a motion with the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, asking them to kind of make Apple open that up to them. They've also, as you know, been reportedly unhappy about the 0.15% that Apple collects from each transaction. The banks down there only take about 1% of each transaction that is done. So Apple taking 0.15%, that sort of eats into the bank's profits from payment processing. So they're upset about that. But really, most recently, they've been trying to do this fight to open up the NFC. And they've also asked for the ability to kind of negotiate with Apple as a group. Typically, Apple goes in and they do deals with each bank individually. But the banks, the larger banks, want to be able to get together and sort of do this collective bargaining thing. And they have to ask for permission from the Australian Consumer Commission to do that. And that proposal also, I guess, apparently got rejected. So I assume the concern on the bank's part is if they're doing negotiations individually, that maybe if one bank gives in or one bank might get a better deal than the other bank, that's just going to lessen their leverage that they might have with Apple. And so after Apple refused to open up that NFC chip, the banks did file a lawsuit trying to get that opened up. And there was a draft ruling that was released last week that seems to indicate that the court is probably going to rule in Apple's favor. A final decision was expected to be announced in March, or is expected to be announced in March, but also later in the week, kind of after this story hit, the banks seem to be hedging their bets because they've already reapplied with a new proposal to the ACCC with a request that kind of narrows the focus of what they were originally asking for with respect to the NFC chip. Now, Apple, of course, is defending their choice to keep the NFC chip closed, saying that opening up would actually undermine the security and simplicity of what they built with Apple Pay and the iPhone. And in fact, Apple Vice President Jennifer Bailey made some comments that indicated that the slow adoption in Apple Pay in Australia is actually being caused by the fact that they can't negotiate directly with the banks. It's slowing down the process. They're having to go through the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, the ACCC, and that is really hindering Apple's efforts to kind of push things forward. So they'd like to just go, you know, negotiate one by one, but the banks are really pushing back on that, apparently. And the banks claim that really they're doing it because they want to defend consumer choice. They're trying to protect competition. And they claim that Apple, if they're able to go forward with Apple Pay and keep the NFC closed, that they would have a stranglehold, quote, on this technology, and that no actual competition could take place in the mobile wallet market space. And when I heard that, I thought that's going to be a little bit hard to argue, I think. I think it's a little bit crazy considering the fact that you have other mobile wallet systems that aren't Apple's. You have Samsung Pay, I think Alipay from Alibaba, PayPal, MasterCard PayPass, Android Pay, Google Wallet, and probably a bunch of others that I can't really think of right now. The argument, I guess, is that iPhone customers would be locked into only Apple Pay as an NFC payment system, and the banks want to be able to put their own apps with their own systems on that platform. Of course, Apple's saying that's going to, you know, undermine and compromise or potentially compromise the security of our customers and their data. So Apple is sticking to their guns and the battle is being fought. So we'll have to see how all this pans out. I think ultimately Apple will probably get their way, but we'll just keep an eye on it. And again, if you're in that region and you happen to know a little bit more detail or just want to weigh in on your opinion, how do you feel about this? If you are an Australian consumer, does this feel like the banks are trying to protect you, or is this more what Apple is thinking, that the banks are just upset about the fee system and they're sort of pushing back to kind of hinder the adoption or the rollout of Apple Pay in the region? You know, despite what's happening there, Apple Pay is in the U.S. expanding pretty quickly. If you remember the quarterly results call, the last one, Apple or Tim Cook announced that Apple Pay transactions were up 500% year over year. And here in the U.S., they're expanding the number of retail locations. As a matter of fact, and this is something I've complained about, it doesn't feel like that many retail locations accept Apple Pay. But according to the latest numbers, there are 16% more of the top 500 retailers in the U.S. accepting Apple Pay in 2016. So 16% more than there were in 2015. And these numbers are from Boston Retail Partners. That means that Apple Pay is now supported by 36% of the top 500 retailers here in the U.S. And that happens to actually be more than PayPal or even MasterCard PayPass. So I was pretty impressed by that number. And even better thing coming out of this report is they say that 22% more of the top 500 merchants say they plan to add Apple Pay in the next 12 months. 11% said they will add it in 1 to 3 years. So we should see much wider rollout and adoption at retail of Apple Pay here in the U.S. I guess my big problem is that it seems like there's almost a marketing issue, that not a lot of people are aware of retailers that are taking Apple Pay. You don't see signs and things at the register. I know that Apple is actually working on that. They've actually created some incentives, and I think they need to do more of that sort of thing. I love using Apple Pay. I don't know if you use it, but it's my preferred. It's becoming really quickly my preferred way to pay, especially with the Apple Watch, the ability to just simply double tap the button, bring up a card, and then just tap to pay and go on my merry way. That's great. I think Apple also has to do some deals with the retailers to get them to sort of lessen or open up the restrictions that some of them have put on Apple Pay transactions. I know at certain retail locations, if it's over a certain amount, you're actually asked to still sign, which is a little weird because you've got the fingerprint authentication, so it's much more secure. And I think those sorts of things need to go away. But that seems to be up to the retailer to decide how they want to implement that. I've had situations where I've had to enter a PIN or sign, and that just sort of slows down and lessens the magical experience of Apple Pay. But I think we're eventually going to get there. Things are getting better, and it's rolling out to more and more countries. And they have received pushback outside of Australia and some other countries, but it seems to be going pretty well for Apple and will probably continue to grow pretty rapidly. Tim Cook recently took a trip across Europe, and once again, he made a number of statements that indicated Apple's extreme interest in augmented reality AR technology. He told The Independent that he regards AR as a big idea like the smartphone. So equating it to that level of technological innovation, and that's led many to believe that Apple is really working hard on developing some sort of AR technology for a future product. Exactly what that is, there's a lot of speculation. It could be a system where the iPhone is sort of the platform, whether it's a set of glasses that's driven by the iPhone or some sort of accessory or device, who really knows? But he once again reiterated that he sees augmented reality technology as something that really improves and enhances the user experience. It's something that you can be present in a conversation and just have additional data and information available to you, but it's not taking you out of the world. And he compared it, as he's done a few times, to virtual reality, which he says, quote, closes out the world. And I've seen a lot of reports sort of commenting that this seems to indicate that Apple isn't interested in VR. I don't think that's the case. We've heard other reports that Apple's looking at virtual reality technologies. I think what it shows is that Apple really sees them as separate things. And they really are. They're separate experiences. They're separate applications for each. And I also think it just sort of indicates that Apple sees augmented reality as something that where they can really make a big impact. Virtual reality, a lot of the applications, as you probably know, are for gaming and video games. And Apple has never been a real big video game company. I know virtual reality has other applications and people are exploring those. But really, when you think about commercial applications and selling a lot of devices or products, it makes sense that Apple might go after augmented reality first. He also talked about his excitement around the ways that augmented reality could improve everyone's lives and be more entertaining. So augmented reality also has some great applications for games. You know, look at Pokemon Go and some of the things that third-party developers are doing as well. So if Apple can open up that technology a little bit more to developers, I think that's going to be the first place where we're going to see AR technology coming to Apple products and iOS devices. And then eventually they may expand out into their own products. Now, someone who might disagree with me is Robert Scoble, who came out very publicly and said that he thinks Apple is working on some sort of augmented reality glasses product. And he talked about that again on This Week in Tech this past week. He claims to have sources at many sources at high levels. And if you remember during CES, he said that he had learned or believed that Apple was partnering with Carl Zeiss Lenses on an AR headset. And the sort of premise for that, in case you don't remember, was that he went to their booth, he knows that they're working on augmented reality technology, but they weren't showing any of that off. And that led him to believe that they have some sort of secret deal with Apple, and Apple had sort of silenced them and said, you can't show this stuff off. And so he claims that he thinks at this point, Apple could make an announcement about an augmented reality system, a new product, as soon as this summer, maybe along with an announcement for Apple Campus 2, or he said possibly alongside the introduction of the next iPhone, the 10th anniversary iPhone, what a lot of people are calling the iPhone 8, which would happen in the fall, sometime in September, October. Whether or not that will happen, I don't really know. Ming-Chi Kuo, for his part, over at KGI, he said that Apple would be shipping a virtual reality system, but he thinks that that's at least a year or two away. Could the two be announced together or be related? I really don't know. I do believe that Apple is going to do augmented reality first. For Apple's part, during the independent interview, Tim Cook said specifically about AR that there are still, quote, things to discover before the technology is, quote, good enough for the masses. So I think Apple's still doing a lot of experimentation. They're trying to figure out, as they always do, what's really the killer consumer application? How do we integrate this technology into our products and services that make it seamless for the user and really work for the user and the consumer experience? It really needs to enhance and make better sort of the process of the things that we do today. And I think that's a harder question to answer. Sure, can you build a set of glasses and throw up some informational displays? You're like, can you show me my tweets as I walk around? Or can you maybe overlay some data and information, walking directions as I'm moving from place to place? Yeah, you can do that. Does that significantly enhance the user experience to what we have today? Maybe. I think in the case of the maps thing, it might. But I think they really want to have a fully fleshed out idea before they release it. So in my opinion, I think Scoble's probably a little off. I don't see it happening this year. In the next year or two, I think we might see something amazing from Apple using this technology. Again, I think they're going to roll it out through apps and other sorts of experiments first, and then really hit us with a big major consumer product, maybe in 2018, 2019. But that's just my opinion. What do you think? A little bit of a scare this week if you're worried about dongles in Donglegate. There were reports that Apple was considering something called an Ultra Accessory Connector, the UAC. It was actually released in a developer preview form, and there were reports that Apple also planned to adopt it as a connector for its Made for iPhone, its MFI licensing program. Now, when people were looking into this new connector, the shape actually looked very similar to something called the Ultra Mini USB connector that you would find on mainly Nikon cameras. Actually, Nikon calls it the UC-E6. It had 8 pins. It was slightly thinner than a USB-C connector, about half as wide. And right now, it looks like the UAC would be mainly used for headphones. It was described as sort of a headphone connector that could carry, the audio and all of the signals for headphones. And it was not clear if the program would expand beyond that application. Well, after all the flack and all the hype and, all the panic, calmness ensued, as it often does, and it turns out the UAC is actually just a new name for an existing connector, that one on the Nikon cameras, and Apple told Ars Technica that the port had been added to the Made for iPhone program at the request of licensees. They wanted the ability to have this connector. So it's really for headphones so that third-party manufacturers can do that and then provide a universal connector that can then connect to Lightning or USB-C or some other connector. So you have a main standard connector on the headphones that they can use for all their different variants that they need to sell to Android customers, computer customers. There's even a cable where you can go from UAC right into a 3.5 millimeter jack. So don't expect to see Apple switching away from Lightning or USB-C anytime soon. Actually, I think they're going to stick with Lightning for at least a little while longer. And I'll kind of explain why when we talk about some of the iPhone stuff a little bit later. But don't panic over the UAC connector. It is being added to MFI, but it's really for the third-party manufacturers of headphones. It's not something that Apple is actually going to be adopting. Reuters came out with a very interesting piece about Apple's new spaceship campus, actually talking about and relaying a number of stories that kind of describe how Apple's fanatical attention to detail in their products is actually spilled over into the construction of their new office space. They say they talked with nearly 24 current and former workers who were involved on the project. Of course, all of them asked to remain anonymous because Apple makes them sign non-disclosures, but they talked to them and they said many of them reiterated stories about Apple's fanatical attention to detail and also claimed that that led to a lot of delays in the project, probably cost overruns. Now, we don't know how much Apple actually spent, but estimates are they're spending about $5 billion on the project. The project was originally set to be completed in 2016. It's now happening sometime in 2017. We're getting really close, but I think it's still a few months away. And apparently, because Apple was so fanatical, it kind of delayed a lot of things. They describe stories like Apple saying, the entire outer surface is enclosed in these giant curved glass panels, actually the largest curved glass panels ever made. And there were specs that said you cannot have any vents or pipes or anything allowed to be reflected in that glass. So you kind of had to design in a way to keep all of that stuff from actually reflecting back and being shown. There were guidelines on the wood that's used extensively throughout the building. Those guidelines were said to be 30 pages long, which actually, I've heard some reports of government specifications, and that actually might actually be pretty short. So I don't know, 30 pages long to specify how the wood surfaces needed to be handled and I guess finished and how they could look and things like that. Apple also reportedly demanded extremely tight tolerances, often tighter than the 1/8 of an inch, which is pretty standard in the construction industry, and even in places where those surfaces wouldn't be ever seen. Does this ring any bells regarding the Mac and Apple's attention to detail inside the computer as well as outside the computer? Yeah, they were drawing a lot of analogies with that in these reports. And they even commented that proportions and designs of a lot of the surfaces in the building came from Apple products. They mentioned specifically in the piece the rounded buttons in the elevators looking like iPhone home buttons. And there was also a story that Apple wanted their doorways to be perfectly flat with no threshold because engineers would have to adjust their gait to kind of move over the threshold, and that could distract them, take them out of what they were thinking about when they were exiting or entering buildings. And the construction people tried to avoid having to do that because as they put it, that was going to be time and money, and it was really stuff that's never been done before. It was going to be hard to do, but Apple persisted, Apple insisted, and so I'm guessing when we see the actual images, the doorways are not going to have any thresholds. They also wanted supposedly minimalistic signage, and the issue there was that also has to comply with regulations. So the fire chief, who was kind of overseeing that, said it took 15 meetings just to get the signage done. He had to attend 15 meetings. And another story said that Apple spent a year and a half, trying to figure out the door handles for conference rooms and offices, and that in the end, they still hadn't sort of resolved how those were going to be designed. So really kind of crazy stuff. On the sort of, you know, design elements, I read a piece and it made a lot of sense talking about, you know, why a lot of the surfaces and the design elements like the elevator buttons and things like that ended up looking like the iPhone home buttons. And it basically said, you know, it's not about Apple insisting that those things look like the buttons or the curves, you know, the rounded corners or things that are in the other parts of the, in their other products, but more that Apple works very hard at trying to figure out exactly these best design aesthetics when they're building their products. And those design aesthetics are kind of universal rules, right? Once you've reached those conclusions, you're going to reach the same conclusions when you're designing other things and you're paying that much attention to details. So in a lot of ways, that makes a lot of sense. But I thought that was kind of a fascinating piece. And, you know, we're starting to see more and more images and videos and things come out about that spaceship campus. Apple's getting very close to opening up, and I have a feeling there's going to be a lot of fanfare and we'll be seeing a lot more videos. But if you've seen any of the drone videos, Apple's released some of their own videos. It's amazing. If you haven't seen them, you might want to do some poking around on Google or YouTube to check them out, because it is going to be a very beautiful space and a very beautiful building. And I'm looking forward to hearing a little bit more about it. There were possible references, I guess, that showed up to maybe some new MacBook Pro models in macOS 10.12.4. That came out for developers, and a blog, an Apple blog called Pikes Universum, noted that there seemed to be three motherboard identifiers that did not exist before and did not match any existing models. They noted that the identifiers were using the exact same processor power management data as in the current 13-inch and 15-inch MacBook Pro models, and that led them to believe that this may be motherboards for a new update. Now, speculation is that they could be four Kaby Lake updated models that might release soonish. In my opinion, I would expect WWDC to be the earliest that we see a MacBook Pro refresh. And really, I think Apple could stick on their normal schedule and wait until the fall. Now, KGI securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo said new Kaby Lake equipped MacBook Pros would enter mass production in the July quarter. So that would actually line up possibly with a WWDC announcement. But I think now that Kaby Lake is available, we should probably see some updates. As far as updates sooner for Macs, we are really overdue for some desktop Mac updates. So I think those are going to be the next ones that we hear about, possibly sometime in the spring or maybe around that WWDC time frame. There was a little bit of a privacy and security scare that happened this week for Apple. Forbes came out with a report from some security researchers at Elcomsoft, and they claimed that they discovered Apple was not deleting iCloud stored Safari browser data as quickly as many of us thought or as they had reported. They were doing some research and discovered that they could get browser history up to over a year after it was deleted. They used their special software to extract information that they downloaded from their iCloud data account or from their iCloud accounts, grabbed that data, processed it through their software, and found that it contained browser history that had been supposedly deleted from the local browser. They also said that their research showed full Google search terms going back a full year, and even cleared notes data that had been expunged in the last 30 days, so they could go back 30 days worth of notes data. The tool that they used does need to have credential access to a user's iCloud account, so someone would have had to have hacked into your account to actually get the data. So really, this was more of a privacy concern than anything else. And just days after this story broke, it was reported that Apple seemed to be removing the old data, and the assumption was that they had resolved the issue and they were kind of cleaning up this bug. Apple made a statement to Apple Insider suggesting that users should be using strong passwords and two-factor authentication to protect their data, because that would actually mean that the data could not be accessed without them knowing, so it would be protected. And that's certainly something you should be doing. But at the same time, you know, as far as privacy goes, Apple should be removing this data more quickly after you delete it than, you know, waiting a whole year. What really seems to be happening here is Apple does have to keep the data for a certain amount of time. It's believed that they would store deleted data for up to 2 weeks. And the reason they do that is to ensure that any devices that you might have connected to your iCloud but maybe aren't turned on or aren't connected at the time, that gives those devices time to actually get synced up. So after 2 weeks, I guess all bets are off. And probably what was happening was they thought they were keeping it for a certain amount of time, and it turned out it was being retained longer. Again, it was still protected behind iCloud, it was encrypted, all those sorts of things, but Apple just shouldn't have been keeping it that long in the first place. And I guess that was kind of the point of this whole thing. Now, some other reports had said that the issue was addressed by Safari 9.1 and iOS 9.3, because those updates added a feature where the URLs that were stored in the browser data were actually hashed and encrypted. But Elcomsoft commented on that and said they had tested with Safari 9.1 and iOS 9.3, they were still able to extract the data. And one of the reasons they might have been able to do that was because, once again, they actually had access to the iCloud account. They were authorized into the account, and the encryption keys for all the stuff that would have been hashed are actually stored with iCloud. So they would have access to those. They would be able to decrypt it. So just to kind of sum up, this was really about the privacy and the data retention, more so than actually any issues over sort of someone getting to or hacking your iCloud account. This next little thing is pretty cool if you're an Apple TV fan. 9to5Mac discovered something that was quietly added to tvOS back with the 10.0.1 update back in October, something that we actually missed. Apple added updates to its app launch feature, Wi-Fi configuration, voiceover, and other accessibility features for third-party accessories. And it's just coming to light now because the specs were recently made available to the accessory makers in Apple's Made for iPhone, iPad, Apple TV licensing program. And so what this means is, for things like App Launch, that lets the accessory actually prompt users to launch or install the companion applications just like on iOS. So if you get a new controller for your Apple TV, you turn it on. If you don't have the companion app that you need for configuring and setting it up, it can actually tell the Apple TV to automatically launch that application or prompt you to install that app so you have it installed. So that's kind of cool. Wi-Fi accessory configuration is for anything you might connect to your Apple TV that would need its own Wi-Fi settings or access to your Wi-Fi network. It can actually prompt the Apple TV for that, and you will no longer have to manually select the right network and go in. It can get the credentials securely and be put right onto your Wi-Fi network without any interaction. And of course, additional voiceover and assistive touch support for accessories, that is a good thing as well. So that's kind of cool to see Apple opening that up to third-party accessory makers. It'll be interesting to see what kinds of devices and products take advantage of that. Also on the Apple TV front, it looks like Apple has hired a former Amazon Fire TV executive to help with their Apple TV efforts. Timothy D. Twirdall is going to lead Apple's TV business, according to Bloomberg. The hire is said to be part of an effort to free up some of the other executives working on Apple TV to work on other products. As a matter of fact, it was noted that Pete Distad, who was leading Apple TV, is now going to be working closer with Eddie Q on more of their content deals. We've talked about Apple expanding content deals, looking to maybe get into some original scripted programs and maybe original movie content. We're not really sure if that's going to be for Apple Music or for some other future update to Apple TV, but this new hire is going to free up some other people to kind of work on those deals. For Twirtle's part, he seems like a perfect fit because before Amazon, he was actually an executive at Netflix and a VP at Roku. So he has extensive experience in this area and should be able to bring that to Apple. And really, it's starting to feel like Apple TV is poised to be a much bigger player in 2017 and the future. Apple, you know, remember, this thing started out, as Steve Jobs called it, as a hobby. It moved away from a hobby quite a while ago under Tim Cook, but now it's actually sort of playing into, I think, the larger part of Apple's overall services strategy. And a lot of these hires and a lot of things that we're seeing going on around Apple TV, I think, are showing that. As a matter of fact, Apple is starting to prep its new original series for Apple Music. And of course, those are going to be available on Apple TV. This week, they released trailers for both Carpool Karaoke and Planet of the Apps, two of their original programs. We've talked about them a little bit, but just to give you a quick rundown, Planet of the Apps is going to be an unscripted reality show that's focusing on developers creating apps and receiving mentorship from various celebrities like Gwyneth Paltrow, Jessica Alba, Gary Vaynerchuk, and will.i.am. And what's going on is it's kind of like, you know, like The Voice or America's Got Talent or any one of these reality shows where you have a bunch of people competing to kind of get money. Shark Tank is kind of the format that it's being compared to, where they get support and money to help develop their products or, you know, kind of start off, kickstart their career, I guess it would be. Now, reportedly, 100,000 apps applied to be featured on the show, and just 100 were selected. And the idea is developers are going to give a pitch. They're calling it the elevator pitch. I think they actually have 60 seconds as they go down a physical elevator to kind of pitch their product. And then at the bottom, there's sort of this Tinder-style swipe left, swipe right sort of thing where the celebrity judges are going to decide if that's something that can move forward. And then from that point, they're going to take those accepted apps and begin to develop them, pair them up with celebrity apprentices, and the celebrity judges are going to act as mentors to help them actually complete their app, leading ultimately up to some sort of final pitch that they're going to give to Lightspeed Venture Partners and get potential access to a $10 million fund that they have to help build their app. And also, successful apps on the show are going to get featured placement on the App Store. So it's going to be really about sort of driving apps on the App Store and also creating entertainment content that's hopefully going to help Apple get more subscribers for their Apple Music service. Again, both of these shows are coming out on Apple Music. Now, Carpool Karaoke, you may have heard of. It started out as this James Corden segment, and it's now being turned into a series by Apple. That's going to be coming out in April. Again, the trailers for both of these are out. You can find them on Apple's YouTube site and I think some other places. But the Carpool Karaoke series seems like it's going to be a little bit different. I never got that into the short clips and videos. I know those were on YouTube. I think they were kind of shared out, but it was just a segment on the show. Now they're going to be full 30-minute episodes. And what apparently they're going to do is they're going to take two celebrities who really don't know each other, put them in a car together, and send them out on a little mini road trip. They're going to go around town and do various things. And actually, it's funny. I thought I was going to be more interested in the Planet of the Apps thing, but after watching the Carpool Karaoke trailer, I think I might check it out. I mean, both of these things are a little bit goofy. They're kind of lifestyle shows. I think they're really kind of targeted at that crossover segment of people who are really into watching online videos, things on YouTube, short clip things, and trying to get them moved into a more full-featured program and onto the Apple Music platform. And it really is a big part of why Apple is exploring and launching their own original content on Apple Music. Eddie Q has said it a few times. They're using it to separate themselves from the other streaming music competitors. And Apple's services business is a really big deal for them right now. It is the fastest growing segment of their business. And of course, Apple Music is a big part of that strategy. And Eddie Q was at the Recode Media Conference speaking recently. He reiterated the fact that Apple Music is now, quote, well past 20 million subscribers. That well past comment was a little bit interesting because they announced that they had 20 million subscribers in December. So if they've moved well past that in just a couple months, that means they're growing very, very quickly. Not quickly enough, apparently, though, because he also talks about the exponential potential of the Apple Music service, commenting that there are 100 million people who subscribe to streaming music services now, but that there are even more people who actually listen to music. And it seems like those are the potential customers that Apple is going after. And they also discussed Apple TV content as trying to be more interactive than traditional linear programs. So they talk about the fact that they can do more things in terms of driving other content. So you can be watching a show, and if you get to a particular point where you're interested in something and it's maybe stuff that got cut out or didn't make the final cut of an episode, they may offer you or give you the ability to drill in deeper at that point in the show and then kind of come back to it. So you can go out on these little tangents and then come back. You don't have to watch in this linear manner. They didn't elaborate much beyond that, and who knows how that's going to integrate into, say, like the music app as you're watching. But apparently there's going to be a little bit of a different experience than you might get with watching traditional television. They're saying it's going to be a little bit more interactive. So it'll be interesting to see what Apple does in that arena, because many times we've seen attempts at making television more interactive, and a lot of them just kind of fall flat, at least in my opinion. So maybe Apple can do something different, or maybe it'll be just as gimmicky. Who knows? But the new shows are going to be featured under a new TV and movies section that will appear under the Browse tab in the music app when these things launch. Again, we know that Carpool Karaoke is going to come out in April. I'm not sure what the release date is for the other show, Planet of the Apps. They haven't commented on that. But the last thing that Eddie Q noted in this interview that is of particular interest to me is he said, quote, "We are working on new features for podcasting. Stay tuned." What those new features are or what they could add, I don't really know. Hopefully they bring back support. The biggest thing they could do for me, bring back support for chapterized podcasts or enhanced podcasts in GarageBand. If they just do that, I will be a happy camper. But maybe there'll be more cooler stuff available for us podcasters in the future. At least that's what Eddie is telling us. So I look forward to that. Let's real quickly talk about Apple Watch. Apple Watch sales are going well, and Apple Watch seems to be leading the smartwatch segment. Canalys estimated that Apple Watch sales are around or were around 6 million units last quarter and accounted for about $2.6 billion in smartwatch revenue. If accurate, that would mean that Apple has about 80% of the smartwatch category, and that would be up 12% from the same quarter last year. Canalys believes that the lower price point of the Apple Watch Series 1 and Apple's focus on marketing the Apple Watch, specifically in the areas of fitness, have really helped drive up Apple Watch sales. And I think I would generally agree with that. I'm seeing a lot more Apple Watches in the wild. I haven't really asked people what they're buying, so I'd be curious to ask you, if you know, are your family members or are you buying Apple Watch Series 1, Series 2? I upgraded and I love my Apple Watch Series 2. I love the actually Series 0 that I had, and Series 1 is even better. So I think the fact that Apple made the conscious effort to actually update the Apple Watch Series 1 with the new processor and things like that made it very appealing. It's also at a very appealing entry level price point. And of course, Tim Cook seemed very pleased with Apple Watch during their first quarter conference call, even noting that demand had outstripped supply. So I think even Apple was caught off guard with how many Apple Watches they were actually selling. Having the next iPhone may take even more money out of your pocket than you might be expecting. The iPhone has never been cheap, right? If you want to be on the cutting edge, if you want to have the next version of every iPhone, you're going to be spending a pretty penny. But Fast Company this week says that sources are telling them the iPhone 8 or the 10th anniversary iPhone, you know, the one with the new design, the all-glass model, the edge-to-edge display, the one that all the fanboys are going to be lusting after, maybe even me, and that's going to be a hard sell because, as you know, I am not a fan of the large size devices, and the thought of a 5.8-inch iPhone just really doesn't appeal to me. But these new materials and some of the advanced features I'm hearing about, I'm getting excited about. Well, if you want all that, it could cost you more than $1,000 US. And as I heard this story, yes, it's shocking, but it's really not that shocking considering that the current top-of-the-line iPhone, the 256-gigabyte iPhone 7 Plus, is priced just barely under $1,000 at $949. And what we're hearing is that that top-of-the-line, the iPhone 8, the premium model, that 10th anniversary edition, we're probably going to have one model. It's probably going to have more than 256 gigabytes of storage, so 512 gigabytes of storage. Maybe they'll do a 256 and a 512. It's supposed to have more storage. It's going to have that edge-to-edge OLED display, which is more costly. There have also been mentions of features like retinal scanning and a bunch of other stuff. That could drive the price up. There's a number of things that could drive the price up, and it would not be that surprising to see it over $1,000. And before you say that's too expensive, there are going to be a lot of people who are going to be willing to pay that. And the report also does seem to confirm that there will still be a 4.7-inch and a 5.5-inch updated model. Many places are calling those the iPhone 7S and 7S Plus models. The design is expected to stay the same, but it will have new technology on the inside. It just won't have all the latest and greatest technology that the top-of-the-line phone will have. So we're all going to have to decide with our wallets which model we are going to go for. Now, KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo notes that the new glass design may be contributing to that higher price point because manufacturing costs are going up. You know, we've heard these reports that there's going to be wireless charging in the units. That can cause more heat. And when you have an all-glass design, guess what? Glass does not dissipate heat as well as metal. So you have to deal with that. And he said, because of that, Apple's having to incorporate a graphite layer to protect the film 3D touch sensor from the heat. And that is extra manufacturing costs, along with the extra costs of, say, like the OLED display. And if Apple's manufacturing costs go up, that means we're going to have to pay a little bit more for that model. And he does still believe that all three models are going to offer wireless charging, although that's come into debate recently. Some rumors have said that that would, again, be a feature reserved for only the highest-end model. Another thing that's come up this week is the possibility of this new 3D touch sensor, or this 3D sensor technology, rather, not 3D touch, of a new 3D sensor technology that may make its way into the iPhone to be used for facial recognition or augmented reality applications. Ming-Chi Kuo and Cohen and Company analyst Timothy Akuri have both mentioned the feature in recent reports. Akuri thinks that the facial or gesture recognition technology could be powered by a laser sensor and an infrared sensor located near the front-facing camera. So facial recognition rather than maybe Touch ID to actually authenticate into your phone. Now, I'm not really so sure how I feel about this. I love the Touch ID sensor. I think it is an elegant and simple way, secure way to authenticate into the phone. The facial recognition would have to be really good from like multiple angles to the point where all I have to do is pick up my phone and it recognizes that it's me. And how quickly that works and how it operates becomes a pretty big deal. At this point, I feel like I can take my iPhone out of the pocket, my pocket, and as I'm taking it out, I just place my finger on the Touch ID sensor, or really now just press the home button and boom, I'm into my phone. So it's going to have to work that well. Apple's acquired some amazing companies in the area of facial recognition, so maybe they can pull it off. but it's going to have to be really good, I think, for me to, and most consumers to, prefer it over Touch ID. Now, I want to move back to the wireless charging technology for a little bit, because another thing we were hearing about this week was the fact that the wireless charging accessory, you know, the thing that will allow you to use the wireless charging that's going to be built into these phones, is actually going to be sold separately. And I think that actually makes sense. This is going to be an option. It's not going to be the only way you'll charge the device. You're still going to have the Lightning connector. Apple's still going to include a Lightning to USB cable in the box. But if you want wireless charging, you're going to buy a separate product, probably $29, $39 if you want to have wireless charging. It's also being said that this iPhone will not include the 3.5 millimeter to Lightning headphone adapter, and I'm also buying that rumor as well, because this is what Apple typically does. In the year of a major change, they give you the little adapter so that you can still use your old technology. In the following year, they take it out because in Apple's mind, it's time to move on. It's time to use something else. And to be honest with you, and I know there are exceptions, and I'll probably hear from some of you, but I have never plugged a set of 3.5 millimeter headphones into my iPhone since I got it. Well, I take it back. I did it one time to actually test out the Lightning adapter so that I could talk about it on the show. Other than that, I've been using Bluetooth headphones and more recently my AirPods, which I absolutely love. And I'm convinced that, you know, the wireless is the way to go and the way I will be using headphones in the future. I've plugged in the Lightning EarPods that came with my iPhone just once as well. Now, the report didn't comment on that, and I assume Apple would still include the Lightning EarPods. So you're still going to have a pair of wired headphones that you will be able to use with the iPhone in the box. But kind of moving back to the wireless charging thing, something else that happened this week, Apple has officially joined the Wireless Power Consortium. This is the governing body behind the QI charging standard. That sort of kicked off a lot of speculation that, hey, maybe the iPhone will work with the QI standard. Before you get too excited about that, just note that the Apple Watch currently uses technology based on the QI standard. Hopefully I'm saying that right. I don't know if it's QI or key standard, but whatever it might be, Apple Watch uses it, although it uses a tweaked version of it. It's an authenticated proprietary variant that Apple developed, and that's why it's locked to Apple's own charger system. And I can almost guarantee you that if Apple does wireless charging on the iPhone, it's going to be the same or a very similar system. So don't expect that, you know, you can go out and buy any third-party brand, say Anker QI-supported wireless charger and use it with your iPhone. It's just not going to happen. Ming-Chi Kuo also reported that the iPhone 8 will have a similar sized battery to the iPhone 7 Plus, and that Apple's going to be able to accomplish that because they're going to change the logic board design to use a stacked logic board in the new iPhone. So the logic board will take up less space, allowing for more battery. So fully expect, especially with the lower power OLED display, that the iPhone 8 should have some pretty amazing battery life. Getting back to the iPhone 8 design and the screen, we've been hearing a lot about different screen sizes, anywhere from 5.1 to 5.8 inches. And now with a new report from Ming-Chi Kuo, we may understand why there was so much confusion. He's claiming now that the iPhone 8 will actually have a screen with 5.15 inches of usable area. Now, you might be thinking, well, Adam, we've been hearing all these reports that that screen is going to be a 5.8 inch screen. And that is still the case. Kuo is still saying it's going to be 5.8 inches, but you're going to lose a significant portion to something he is calling the function area, a little strip along the bottom of the phone that is reportedly going to replace the Touch ID sensor. And Kuo is even saying that Touch ID is going to be going away, possibly going away, and then Apple may be using other biometric technologies to allow you to get into your iPhone. And we've heard, again, both this idea of facial recognition and possibly Apple adding a retinal scanner to the iPhone. Again, I'll just reiterate, two technologies that I don't think are going to be superior in terms of user experience to Touch ID, but we'll give it to them. What's interesting about this new function bar thing is it got me thinking, well, is Touch ID really going away, or is this little function area going to be like a little mini version of Apple's Touch Bar technology? Quo doesn't specifically mention that in his piece, but when I'm thinking about it, what if you had a little 3 or 4 button Touch Bar area on your iPhone? And you remember, the Touch Bar on the MacBook Pro actually has a little square Touch ID sensor integrated into it. So maybe that's what's going on there. And then you have the 5.1-inch usable display area. So kind of this taller phone wraparound screen with a 5-inch screen. Interesting to think about. I think many people would prefer a 5.8-inch screen with about 5.8 inches of usable area. So it'll be interesting to see how Apple spins this and tries to sell it. But interesting new report from Ming-Chi Kuo, and certainly something to ponder on a little bit. As far as getting these things out to the public, we've got reports this week that Apple is probably already ramping up production on the new iPhone, and that's earlier than they have done in the past. And it's probably due to the fact that they've got a lot of new components in here. There's concerns over yield quantities, especially with things like the OLED display. And so Apple needs to get a jump on those things so that they make sure that they have enough supply and production levels to get these out to all the consumers who are going to want them. And it's seeming like they're expecting huge demand, because reportedly Samsung signed a deal with Apple this week to make 160 million more OLED displays. This is according to the Korea Herald. Back earlier last year, there was a report that Apple had made a deal with Samsung for 100 million 5.5-inch displays, and now this new deal is said to be for 5-inch OLED displays. So that would seem to indicate that these are different display deals. That's 260 million OLED displays. Now, what was confusing about this story to me is supposedly the iPhone 7S Plus may not have an OLED display. That would be the 5.5-inch screen, because the new deal being for a 5-inch OLED display, 160 million 5-inch displays, that seems to match up with what Kuo is saying about the iPhone having about a 5.1-inch usable display area, right? Somewhere in that range. So I would assume this new deal is for the new phone, and that maybe, just maybe, and again, no other place is reporting this, I'm just speculating based on this latest report, maybe the iPhone 7S and 7S Plus could be getting OLED displays. That would be an amazing thing. Again, no one else has been reporting this. It's probably not likely, but hey, maybe it could happen. But it's still expected that the iPhones are going to come out in the September timeframe. So even though Apple's ramping up component orders earlier, they've asked their chip suppliers to start trial production and inspection, start beginning to prepare inventories, it's still looking like this is all for a ramp up, just an earlier ramp up to a September release of a new iPhone. And then finally, in the news for this week, Apple has suspended sales of the LG UltraFine 5K display at Apple retail stores. This is according to 9to5Mac. They've also pushed delivery dates for online sales for that display back from 2 to 3 days to 5 to 6 weeks. And this move seems to be in response to what we talked about, I think, last week, the fact that the current models were suffering from an issue of interference with Wi-Fi routers. When they got close to Wi-Fi routers, the displays were getting messed up. They were having problems. They were actually crashing Macs and things like that. LG confirmed the issue and announced that they were addressing it by shipping out new models in February that have additional shielding. So it's looking like what's happening is that LG wants to make sure that all new stock going out is the updated version of their display. And that was actually confirmed by Apple, who said that they pulled existing 5K monitor stock from Apple stores at LG's request while they worked on new hardware, while they were manufacturing that new hardware. And just to say something finally about Apple's decision to move away from making their own high-end displays. When Apple announced this, it sounded logical to me. It sounded like a good way to go, right? Apple getting out of the display business. I don't think they sell a lot of displays, and they partnered up with LG on these new 4K and 5K ultra-fine displays. And, you know, Apple's always had other manufacturers make the panels for their displays. They just kind of oversaw production. This time around, they're letting LG do it, and for as much as it sounded like a good idea, they seem to be having a lot of problems right out of the gate. Not that this couldn't have happened to Apple if they were doing it on their own, but Apple doesn't have a history of having real big issues with their displays. And right after these displays came out, I started getting reports from listeners to this show saying that they were having crashing issues when waking from sleep when they had their displays connected. And I confirmed with a number of those people that no, they did not have them near Wi-Fi routers. So that was not the issue. It was some sort of other thing. And they really didn't know what it is. I had another user who had ordered one of the 4K displays and said that every time he woke up his Mac, or often when he would wake up his Mac, the display would not wake up. So the main display would come on, but the LG 4K display would not come on. And the only way to resolve the issue would be to do a full reboot of his entire system. Incredibly annoying. And then to make things worse, he contacted Apple support. And of course, Apple support says, well, that's not our display. We can't help you with that. Sends him over to LG support. And LG, of course, turns out to be less than helpful with trying to resolve his issue. And ultimately, just ended up returning the display. Because who wants to deal with that hassle? So these are the kinds of experiences that I'm hearing about. And unfortunately, it's not the kind of story I want to hear. I want to hear that Apple did this partnership with LG and it turned out to be amazing. They have these amazing displays and it's just as good as it was before. But it's really starting to not feel like that. So hopefully this is just a, you know, first time out, slight production hiccup, and they can get these issues resolved quickly, maybe with some software updates. It's good that Apple and LG, at least behind the scenes, have a good relationship. Apple may need to work a little bit on the support side of things, though, it sounds like. I mean, if they're going to sort of give LG the blessed title of these are the guys we recommend you buy a display from, I think it behooves Apple to maybe take on some of the support responsibility for that. I don't know, maybe I'm being a little bit extreme there, but I think that's reasonable to do. And maybe they can partnership with LG there to get a little bit better support. Maybe LG can give some training to Apple's staff on how to support these displays a little bit better, especially if they're going to continue forward with this as being the way that you get a display for your Mac. But certainly there have been a few issues, and again, here's hoping that they get them worked out pretty quickly. But with that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is GoDaddy. GoDaddy's mission is to radically shift the global economy toward life-fulfilling independent ventures. They help their customers succeed by giving them the tools, insights, and people to transform their ideas and personal initiative into success. With more than 14 million customers worldwide and more than 62 million domain names under management, GoDaddy gives small business owners the tools to name their idea, build a beautiful online presence, attract customers, and manage their business. GoDaddy is the world's largest technology provider dedicated to small businesses and the largest domain registrar. They offer award-winning 24/7 customer support to help build your online business and provide everything you need to get your business online. Whether you have a new idea or are an established business, the key to success online starts with a great domain name. They offer big savings over other registrars and are trusted by 13 million customers more than any other registrar. Right now, GoDaddy is offering MacCast listeners 30% off all new products. Just go to GoDaddy.com and enter the coupon code MacCast30 at checkout. That's GoDaddy.com and enter the code MacCast30 to save 30% off all new products. And a big thank you to GoDaddy for their support of the MacCast. Last week, we talked about the amazing first quarter numbers from Apple. Apple had a record-breaking quarter. iPhone sales had rebounded. Everything was looking good. It was amazing. And I was pretty excited about it. I know Apple was even more excited about it. But I have to say, there are some naysayers out there. There are some non-believers in our community who want to point out that because last quarter had one extra week versus the same quarter in 2015, that somehow detracts from Apple's first quarter numbers of 2017. So I guess it was the 2016 first quarter had one less week than the 2017 first quarter. And this is Apple's first financial quarter. So I know it gets confusing because Apple's first quarter of 2017 is actually in 2016. But aside from that, there are some naysayers saying, hey, Apple didn't do as well because there was this whole extra week. And I think that Apple's CFO, Luca Maestri, did a great job of sort of addressing this and explaining why that doesn't really matter. And by the way, these quarterly numbers are still amazing. So I wanted to talk about that a little bit because I received some feedback. I had a couple of people point out that there was this extra week. And really, if you look, iPhone 7 launched earlier than it had in the past. It actually launched in the prior quarter ahead more weeks than it ever had before. So actually more of the big push, those first sales, were actually happening in the previous quarter, which kind of offsets the whole launch demand thing. So if you want to compare 2016 to 2017 Q1, you have to take that into account. So more launch sales were in the third quarter rather than, or in the fourth quarter rather than in the first quarter. Also, he pointed out that Apple grew channel inventory significantly less this year, and also the fact that iPhones were more expensive abroad due to the strength of the US dollar, so that also has an impact on the number of units sold. So ultimately, the point is that, you know, there are always factors in every quarter that are going to be different in a given year. It's, you know, it's going to be one way or the other. So you can't really start sort of slicing things down and saying, well, this one had one more week or, you know, this sort of thing. Yeah, just how calendars work out. Sometimes quarters are going to have more weeks. Sometimes they're going to have less. But we don't compare things that way. There's not always necessarily this apples to apples comparison, but we have this baseline that we've always kind of used. Here's one quarter, here's another quarter, and we compare quarter to quarter and year over year, and we've always sort of done that. And so in this case, record numbers are record numbers, and they were still amazing, and we're not going to detract from that by making these little hair splits in terms of our analysis. So yes, we get that there was one more week, but really a moot point, and Apple did extremely well last quarter. Another thing I want to follow up from last episode is alternatives to Time Capsule. We talked about this a little bit because of the rumors that Apple has gotten out of the Airport Extreme and Time Capsule business, and I had received questions from folks who are saying, well, ultimately I'm going to need to upgrade my Time Capsule, so what else can I do? And we recommended a couple NAS solutions, things like Drobo and Synology systems, and I also talked a little bit about the Western Digital MyCloud drives, mentioning that these are great NAS drives that support Time Machine backups, but I had not personally used them. So I asked for some confirmation from some of you who actually own Western Digital MyCloud drives, and I received feedback from many of you that said, yeah, these are a great solution. I'm actually, you know, I had people write in and say, I'm actually using these. It worked out very smoothly. I bought one. I hooked it up on my network, was able to see it with my Time Machine on my Mac just fine, and setup was quick and easy. So definitely a solution that you can look into. And I thank everybody for writing in and giving me confirmation on that. But I also received another great tip on a backup solution, a network backup solution that supports Time Machine that I had not thought about. And why I hadn't thought about this, I have no idea. I guess I just forgot. And that tip was you can use a Mac on your network and OS X server. You just install Mac OS X server on it, and that has a built-in Time Machine service. And for those of you who don't know, the way Mac OS server works now is it's just an add-on that you can buy through the Mac App Store for about $20 US. It's an upgrade to Mac OS 10.11.6 or later. So you just go on to the App Store, you buy it, and install it. I think it runs almost like a separate little application or service, really kind of like a configuration application. As you can tell, I've never personally used it, but in looking at the instructions online, it seems fairly straightforward to set up a Time Machine backup. So this could be a great potential use maybe for an older Mac that you have lying around if you want to set it up kind of as a dedicated Time Machine backup. And what you do is you install the software, you enable the Time Machine backup service, and then within that service, you set a backup destination. And this could be the internal drive. I think it could also be an external drive connected to that Mac. And you even have the ability to limit the amount of storage that would be used for the Time Machine backup portion. So you could say, look, set aside 500 gigabytes of this internal drive, this 1 terabyte internal drive for Time Machine backups over the network. And then you could connect your other Macs to that and let them use that as the network storage for Time Machine backup. And once you've enabled the Time Machine service, just note that it also does turn on the file sharing service on that Mac. So you want to make sure for security purposes that you go in and you set the permissions, make sure that guest sharing is not turned on for your Time Machine file so that other people can't get into that if they were on your home network. But once you've got that set up, it's pretty straightforward. You go into Time Machine on the Mac that you want to back up that's connected to the same network, and you should just see that Time Machine service volume that you set up on the machine running Mac OS server. And that's really it. And it's all Apple integrated technology. It's all built in, and you don't need a dedicated time capsule unit to set it up. Just a Mac running 10.11.6 or later and the latest version of Mac OS X server. So hopefully I described that process correctly. Like I said, I have not set this up myself, but many of you wrote in to say, this is the solution that I came up with, and it's working really well for me. So if others of you have an opinion on that or have other alternatives you're using to kind of get around this issue of replacing a time capsule when there's not something to replace it with, shoot us an email, give us a recommendation or a suggestion, maccast@gmail.com, and I look forward to your emails. Another thing we kind of touched on the last episode of the MacCast was the iOS 10.3 beta, which had been released out to developers, and a big change that was in there was that Apple is switching over to a new file system. As a matter of fact, they announced at WWDC that they were going to be moving to a new file system away from HFS Plus, which we've used for, believe it or not, about 30 years. No, we haven't been using it for the 30 years on the Mac, but it's been around for about that long. It was born in 1989, and I don't think we've been using it since then. Maybe it has been the standard on the Mac since 1989. But point being, it's an old, old file system, and Apple's going to be replacing it on Mac OS and on iOS with this new system called Apple File System, or APFS. And they're starting with, it looks like they're going to be starting with iOS 10.3. And like I said, they released a preview of it for Mac OS to developers at WWDC in June, and they're now testing it. So I had been wondering a little bit about Apple File System. I hadn't looked into it too much. And luckily this past week, Rene Ritchie over at iMore, like he does very often, wrote an amazing article that talks about what you need to know about APFS. And I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. You really should head over there and read the entire article. But I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, maybe why this is happening, why it matters, why do we even care about this? Why should I even go read Renee's article to learn a little bit more? And it comes down to this, you know, what's wrong with HFS Plus? It works well. Well, you know, the one thing I already mentioned is it's really, really old. It was designed for computers and designed for a time when we did not have fast flash storage or SSDs. Also, our storage options were much smaller. We didn't have, you know, multi-terabyte sized drives that were connected to our devices. We also didn't have iPhones or iPads. We didn't have these little, you know, handheld computing devices. We had desktops and laptops. So it was just a different time, and the whole thing was engineered for something different. And speaking of that, because of that, Apple's engineers have been having to sort of patch HFS Plus to meet the current needs, and they continue patching it and sort of hacking it and bolting on a series of things to make it do things it was never really originally designed for. And that's fine, but it starts to get kind of bloated and crusty and just show signs of age, like many things do when you're talking about computers. And another problem is that the tweaks and things are different for different devices and different formats and different variants of the operating system. So it's implemented differently in different ways across different platforms, and that just makes managing it and dealing with it that much more complex. So the idea behind APFS, Apple File System, is that you can have a single code base that can be used and scaled across all kinds of different devices. And because of that, it actually might feel a little bit faster because it can focus on modern things like low latency and offering fast directory resizing and those sorts of things. So that means we can actually get info on a folder in the Finder and maybe see that information a lot more quickly. You don't have to wait for it to kind of crunch and calculate and figure out what's the storage size. So I'm looking forward to that in, you know, a new modern operating system. And also, Apple File System can be built from the ground up for flash storage, for SSDs, for optimizing the way that it works and actually supporting things like trim so that we can have our SSDs and our flash last longer and be able to run through more read-write cycles and those sorts of things. Some of the extra features and new modern features that we're going to get with Apple File System are support for things like snapshots and clones. And I didn't really know what these were. We're not going to get into great detail, but basically snapshots are read-only copies of the system at any given point in time, and changes from snapshots can always be reverted. And clones are basically copies of your files, and both clones and snapshots end up using space more efficiently because they actually don't cause the file system to duplicate any data until actual changes are made. So again, saving on those read-write cycles potentially for things like SSDs, which can become pretty important. Another big advantage of Apple File System is that partitions can be resized because it actually uses containers that exist all around all of the partitions that are on a drive. So we can resize partitions, and those containers support sparse files. So they only store storage is only allocated when it is actually needed. So it's not going to be eating up a bunch of drive space or kind of setting aside or chunking out a piece of space that's not going to be usable if you should need it. So the ability to kind of resize and do all that sort of stuff on the fly, which is a big deal. If you've talked to anybody who's ever partitioned drives and then had to repartition them, it's a giant pain in the butt under HFS Plus. So we're going to solve some of those problems. And there's also just more error correction, data redundancy, error checking, data protection, all those sorts of things. It does something called a copy on write, in which a file is actually copied, that's being copied is only deleted when it's written and verified the new version of that. So if something were to happen, you can actually revert back, the system can revert back and get back. And so you're going to potentially suffer less data loss when you're doing copy write, you know, sort of operations and those sorts of things. And it has been designed from the ground up, Apple File System, with support for encryption at all levels. That includes not just the operating system level, the file system level, but even at the level of specific data and metadata. So you can kind of get granular on the data encryption. At this point, though, you know, it's not quite ready for prime time. The file system is still not finished. It's missing a lot of the things that we do now have in HFS Plus. Currently, compression isn't built in. Data checksums aren't there. And the data checksums, Renee's piece notes that Apple may not put those in there because they kind of feel that error code correction, ECC on the flash might be enough. I'm sure there's some philosophical debate, and maybe some of you have some opinions on that. If you happen to know a little bit more about file systems and these kinds of technologies, if you want to write in and enlighten us, that would be great. I welcome those comments and that feedback. But that stuff's not done. And another problem with Apple file system right now, and this is kind of a huge problem in my mind, is it currently doesn't work with startup disks, Time Machine, File Vault, or Fusion drives. So it has a ways to go before we're going to see it in macOS. iOS, it does look like it's going to happen soon, maybe with 10.3. Obviously, there's less variables for Apple to deal with on the iOS side. But it's coming. It's something we've needed for a long time. We've talked about various file systems over the years. Remember a while back, there was this whole idea that Apple might adopt ZFS. But it's looking like Apple file system is going to be the thing, and I'm sure we're going to be hearing a lot more about it. Again, if you want to drill into this and get into a lot more detail, check out Renee Ritchie's piece over at iMore. Again, links in the show notes at maccast.com. So if you've been using a Mac for any period of time, actually probably a computer for any period of time, you know the tried and true method for copying and pasting something. And no, it's not just going to file menu and choosing copy and then file menu and choosing paste. Most of us, I think, at this point know the keyboard shortcuts for copy paste. Command C, Command V. We do it all day, all the time, a lot. But these days, more and more, you might encounter situations where when you're copying something and pasting it someplace else, you're not getting the results you're expecting. So if you're expecting to, say, copy a link, and this is a common example, you're copying a link maybe from a web page in Safari, you're pasting it into an email or some other location, maybe into a note in the Notes application. You copy the link, and when you paste it, what you get, you're expecting to get the URL, right? But what you actually get is a text link. So you get the text with the link just like you would in Safari, or maybe you're getting a little preview of the thing if you're in Notes, because Notes is doing its magical little, I forget what Apple calls it, but you know, where it actually shows the title of the page and maybe a little image and something like that. It's doing that fancy stuff. And that may or may not be what you want. If you wanted to actually paste the URL and you wanted to be able to see the URL, then that's not quite right. Basically, it's copying not just the content, but also all of the formatting and bringing all of that over. And what you might not know is there's actually a pretty simple solution for this if your intent is to just get the raw data, the raw information. So in addition to Command V pasting in macOS, many apps give you support for what's called paste and match style. I've also, I think, seen paste as plain text, and you may or may not see it under the edit menu, but just adding the shift key to your paste shortcut, so doing Command Shift V usually works. So if you're pasting something in and you're getting a bunch of formatting that you don't want, try Command Shift V, and you will more likely get the unformatted or sort of raw content, even though it's called paste and match style. What it means by match style is match the style of the thing I'm pasting into. Don't bring all the style and formatting that's copied to the clipboard along for the ride. So I bring this up because Fernando emailed me and was wanting to know, is there a way to change the default paste behavior, Command V behavior, so that it always does paste and match style always does the command shift V version. And he wanted to do this universally. And Fernando, I don't know of any way, or I couldn't think of any way to actually do this, but maybe someone in the MacCast community does. So if you do happen to have an answer for this, let us know, other than doing command shift V. But one possible hack, and I'm calling this a hack, it's more like an override or thing you could try, is overriding the shortcut using the keyboard preferences on the Mac. So if you go into System Preferences, into Keyboards, and then click on the Shortcuts tab, you can select App Shortcuts from the sidebar, and then you can click the little plus button to add a new shortcut, and then add the shortcut for all applications. I think it gives you an option there. And then what you can do is, for the menu title of the shortcut that you're adding, just make sure you type in exactly what it says for paste and match style in the file drop-down menu. So paste and match style with a capital P on the word paste, a capital M on the word match, and a capital S on the word style. Paste and match style, you enter that into the menu title, and then you can set its shortcut command to command V and choose add. And what should happen in most cases is your new command V shortcut that you added through the keyboard preferences should override the default paste command, at least in any apps that support the paste and match style option under the file menu. It should work. I don't know that it's guaranteed to always work in every application, which is why I'm saying this is a little bit of a hack and probably isn't exactly the solution you're looking for, Fernando, but it may work in a pinch. And again, hopefully someone in the MacCast community has another alternative for us. And if I get that, I will certainly share it on a future episode of the MacCast. But thanks for your question. Frank also wrote in this week with a little bit of a dilemma, because you see, he has a newer iPhone, an iPhone 7, but is trying to use that with an older Mac. And I don't know from your email, Frank, if this is your only Mac or if it's just another Mac that you're trying to do this with. But what he wrote in to ask me about was syncing his photos with the Mac. So as you know, a lot of syncing with our iOS devices and our Macs these days happens through the cloud, probably via iCloud. And so this issue doesn't really become that big of a deal, even though the iPhone 7 technically requires Mac OS 10.9 or later and iTunes 12.5. What's going on in Frank's case is he has a late 2006 20-inch iMac running OS 10 Lion 10.7.5, and he's attempting to sync his photos. And when he connected that new iPhone, that iPhone 7, to that Mac, he got an error message. It said, "Photos in the camera roll of Frank's iPhone cannot be imported because the device is locked with a passcode. You must unlock the device to import them." The thing is that despite what this message says, Frank had unlocked his iPhone and the photos still would not sync. So it's an odd and very misleading message. And I think it's just due to the fact that you have an old operating system on your Mac, or an older operating system on your Mac, and you're trying to connect this newer iPhone running iOS 10, and that iPhone requires 10.9 or later, and you're trying to sync it with a Mac that's running 10.7. So Frank ultimately asks, what can I do? How do I sync my photos? How do I get my photos out of my camera roll on my new iPhone 7 onto my Mac? And I don't have anything to test with, Frank, but my first guess, my first thing that I think I'd have you try is to use image capture. A lot of people don't know that if you go into your applications folder on your Mac, there is a great little application called Image Capture. And Image Capture will actually let you pull photos directly off of your iPhone. You can even actually directly manage the photos on your iPhone. You can do things like delete the photos directly off your iPhone. I think I've covered Image Capture a couple times here on the MacCast, but I would give that a try. See if that will let you at least copy the photos off of your iPhone onto a folder on your Mac. I think you might even be able to go directly into iTunes. Now, I think it's, or iPhoto rather, or yeah, in your case, iPhoto, because I don't think the Photos application actually runs on that version of a Mac either. So you can bring those directly onto your Mac and then dump them into iPhoto. You may even be able to go right into iPhoto. Now, will this work or not? I don't know. You're going to have to give it a shot and tell me, because it may be, image capture is really, I think, kind of the underlying engine that actually runs under iTunes. So you may run into exactly the same problem. So if that doesn't work, I'm going to give you a backup thing to try, and that is to use the app iMazing. Now, iMazing has been a sponsor here on the MacCast, but I have to tell you, it is a great application for getting all kinds of data on or off your iOS devices directly. And best of all, it will run on a Mac running 10.7, and it does have a feature specifically designed for importing your photos either into a folder on your Mac or directly into iTunes. So you should be able to get iMazing and be able to use that to actually transfer your photos. So just kind of bypass Apple's system altogether and go a roundabout way and get those in there. And for everybody else, before you write in and say, what about iCloud Photo Library, which I agree would totally work, because when you have iCloud Photo Library enabled, anything that you, any photo that you take on your iOS device automatically gets synced to iCloud and then automatically gets synced to any Mac that's also connected to iCloud Photo Library. Works great. I love it. I use it on all my iOS devices. But unfortunately, that's only available as of OS 10 Yosemite, so 10.10 or later. And as we already established, Frank is running Lion 10.7 on his Mac. So, Frank, give image capture a try, and failing that, try iMazing, and I think that will take care of things for you. But thanks for your message. One last thing for you today, and that is my thing of the moment, and I am happy to share this one with you. I haven't had a lot of time with this one because it literally just came out today, but I have to tell you, I have been waiting for this game to come out on iOS for a while. I forget when this was announced, probably almost about a year ago. There was an announcement for a great game called Hidden Folks, and what this is a hidden picture style game. But it has this amazing look. They have these amazing hand-drawn little illustrations. It's in black and white. It's really simple. Actually, as a matter of fact, now that I have the app, I know that you can change the color scheme. You can do just like you would with an iBook, sepia or white on black or black and white, however you want. It's got these great hand-drawn illustrations, these great... really mouth done sound effects that happen with the little illustrations that are on the screen. But basically it's like Where's Waldo, but to the next level, because you get a little list of characters or objects or things that you need to find in this amazingly elaborate but, you know, simple, clean illustration, and you need to tap on and interact with things in the game. So you might have characters or things that are hidden behind bushes or foliage, and you have to kind of tap that away or wipe that away, or if you've got to move things, or you've got to roll up doors or open windows or whatever it might be to kind of find these elements. Some are just out in the open, some are in different places. You do get some little hints when you tap on the little images that you're supposed to find. They give you little clues on where you might need to look, because again, these pictures are huge. You got to swipe around, you got to move around in them, you got to zoom in and out. They have great little animations, great little challenges that happen between some of the levels, and it's just fun and amazing. It's a casual style game. It's one of these things that you can open up, look for a couple things. You can choose to find a few, and at a certain point, it'll let you kind of advance to the next level, or you can continue to stick on the level that you're on and maybe try and find all of the images in a given level before moving on. That's how I'm preferring to play the game. But it's been incredibly fun so far. As near as I can tell, again, I've spent maybe an hour or two with it at this point. No in-app purchases. It's just straight up buy the game. enjoy it. I forget how many levels total are in it, but I'll have a link to it in the show notes at MacCast.com. Hidden Folks, it's $3.99 US on the App Store right now, and it's great, which is why it's my thing of the moment for this week. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. I do have my announcement, though, of the person who is going to receive the AirPods from our MacCast AirPods giveaway. I have to say, you are amazing. I received literally hundreds and hundreds of entries, and 100% of you, 100% of you, and this shocked me, got the three secret words right. So the way that you submitted your name for participation in the giveaway was you had to listen to episodes of the MacCast. I gave a secret word at the end of three episodes, and you had to provide those to me along with your submission. And everybody got it right. Unbelievable. So you guys did a great job. You're obviously great fans and great listeners of the MacCast, which I really, really appreciate. But submissions ended at midnight last night, and I randomly selected a name. It was chosen, and the lucky recipient of the AirPods in our giveaway is Peter Staub. Peter, congratulations. We're going to be sending those off to you. I've got them right here. I will try to get them in the mail tomorrow, so hopefully they will be off on their way to you. I've emailed. Once I have your shipping address, they will be out in the mail, and on the way I will follow up with a tracking code. But big thanks to everyone who participated in this giveaway. It was a lot of fun, and hopefully I'll be able to do some more giveaways sometime in the future. So if you didn't receive this one this time, hang in there. We'll maybe try to do a few more of these throughout this year. It could be a fun thing to add to the MacCast in 2017. And I hope you enjoyed participating as well. So thanks for that. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I'd like to thank another one of my great sponsors, and that is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all of their great applications at smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can check them out at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, if you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, either about this episode or something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, maybe you need some help with a problem you're having with your Mac or your iOS devices, I welcome your emails and your audio comments. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on our listener hotline at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9, and leave a voicemail message. And we will try to get back to you and maybe answer your question or address your comment on a future episode of the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or hang out and check out the Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.